In the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Our Lady, Seat of Wisdom. In the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen.
Okay. This particular session is essentially the beginning of the end, I guess would be a proper way to put it. What we've done before, again, is the basic concept of truth, some basic instrumentalities of truth, the concepts of salvation, statues and saints, the Blessed Mother, purgatory. Again, what we did was divide it up thematically, to use a fancy word, from the key point, which was the value of truth all the way through, some instrumentalities, the Bible, the Church, etc., some specific doctrines, salvation, the Blessed Mother. And now what we're trying to deal with is, would be practical instruction. How to deal with a person with whom you are going to try to evangelize. What we tried to do before, if we can use an analogy, was we gave you the weapons. Now we're going to teach you how to use the weapons, or at least give you suggestions on how to use the weapons. And this session is devoted to the concept of personality and the types of personality that you are likely to run into if you attempt to evangelize someone. So therefore, we're trying to forearm you by tipping you off on what you're likely to run into and what motivates people in general. Now, obviously, evangelization is an attempt to persuade a person, to convince a person to change. And that, by definition, brings up the whole concept that you're dealing with a person, you're trying to sell them something in a certain sense. And the central question becomes, what makes someone tick? Or maybe that shows how old I am. That was an old expression used when I was younger. But what is it that drives a person? What's of value to a person? Salesmen are always taught this in training programs. Find out what this guy is of interest with. Build a certain sense of interest in that, and then bridge it over. And what you have to do is to convince the person that he really wants your product, even though maybe he didn't know it. And in a sense, we're in selling. So it is important, or at least it is useful, to try to find out what motivates a person. And generally, this comes under the general big old term of personality, a term we've all used, we've all heard, we all have a meaning for it. And it's a very interesting word. But when we use it here, I think it's important that we understand what it actually means. Personality is a consistent and persistent set of character traits, habits, and values which identify one person and separate him from everybody else. Sure. A consistent and persistent set of character traits, habits, values, activities, which identify one person and separate him from everybody else. If they are not consistent, you're dealing with a disturbed person and there's no way to figure out what his personality is. That's why they'll talk about people with split personalities, people in love-hate relationships, etc. Also, it must be persistent, because obviously on a particular day, any one of us could be ill or particularly feeling well. We could have some very good news or some very bad news. The weather, various, a whole bunch of things can affect our behavior on a particular day. What we're talking about is a persistent, over a period of time, set of personality traits. Again, a person cannot be generous and cheap at the same time. He can be generous when he's young and cheap when he's old. But he cannot be both generous and cheap at the same time, because this is a character trait, and a personality must have consistency. Character traits. Personalities certainly do develop and change. I don't think any of us would say we have the same personality at 8 that we do when we have when we're 80. But at any particular time, a personality is fixed, even if it is going through a transitional stage. All that means is that value system is changing, and what was very important to the person last month is not so important to the person this month. Personality is important in evangelization, because if we can get a handle, so to speak, on a personality type, we are better able to understand the value system of the person involved. And why is that important? Well, one could take the approach, and I've been accused of this myself, of taking evangelization almost in the sense of the guy who has the store in the town, the general store in the town. You come in, you want the product, he's got it, he gives it to you, he takes your money. If you don't want to pay the price, go somewhere else. If you don't like what I carry, go somewhere else. Well, if you're the only store in town, then you don't have to worry about that, because they can't go anywhere else. And one would argue that, or one could argue, or one almost could come to the conclusion that what I've been saying all the way through is we are the only store in town. We're it. We have the monopoly on truth and the monopoly on salvation. Therefore, shouldn't we present it that way? Hey, take it or leave it. That's it. You don't like it, go to hell. Literally. Here's our faith. Accept it or go to hell. Next potential convert, please. I haven't got time to waste with you. We haven't got time to do sales pitches. Well, this is a way to evangelize. There's no two ways about it. And I hold that any act of evangelization whatsoever is better than none. But unless we think it's a one-shot deal where we're only going to see a person once in our entire life, this is not necessarily the best way, and it is not necessarily the most effective way. By the same token, I think this is a way that sometimes does have effects. But again, you don't need anybody to tell you to do that. That's a three-step process which anybody can figure out. If you think that's the right way to do it, fine, and all the rest of this is simply added information which you might find interesting, and it might give you some insights into the guests on Oprah Winfrey and Phil Donahue. But we should, as a matter of an exercise of the virtue of prudence and foresight, increase our odds of succeeding in any way we can. And therefore, we should be truthful, certainly, but we should be more than truthful, we should be persuasive. We should be correct, of course, but we should be more than correct, we should be an influence towards what is correct. We should present, certainly, but we should do more than that. We should also attract. And we should do more than simply threaten or present the penalties of rejection of truth. We should encourage the acceptance of truth and present also the rewards. All right? I think everybody would agree with that. But that doesn't answer the question, how do we deal with different people and how do we figure out what different people are? So to do that, let me go back to some very, very basic concepts. And I think it's interesting that very few people really go back to the real true basics of human behavior. It seems as if we grow up assuming certain things and never bother to examine them. So this should be self-evident, it should be obvious, but I really doubt as if you've ever heard it before. The real reason, the basic understanding of human behavior is that there is only one motivation for any activity. The only reason why anybody ever does anything, ever. The only reason why a person acts, or moves, or asks, or rejects, or decides, or buys, or returns, or sins, or yells, or talks, or walks, or visits, or sleeps, or wakes up, or eats, or drinks, or takes medicine, or goes to a ball game. And that one motivation is that he believes, before he does it, that there will be some improvement of the current condition if he does it. Let me put it in a slightly different way. All human action, now we're talking about purposeful human action. If a guy is walking by a cliff and he falls off, that's certainly human action, but he didn't intend it. And obviously if you go outside when it's raining and you get wet, you didn't intend that either. But that's not what we're talking about. All intentional human action is the result of perceived discomfort. Every time you adjust your sitting position, or scratch, or sneeze, or yawn, it's because you believe that doing so will lessen discomfort. Every time you buy something, it's because you have decided in your heart, or your stomach, or your brain, that you will be uncomfortable without the product you wish to buy. It will ease your discomfort. There are no exceptions to this. Every human action is based on discomfort. People move from one house to another, from one car to another, from one job to another, from one spouse to another, or even from one position when they sleep at night to another, simply because the old position has created a level of uneasiness which they no longer choose to tolerate. Quite frankly, there's an old joke which is told, and it has an insight to this, and it's about the boy who never spoke. And his parents took him to a doctor and found out that physically he was fine, and mentally he was fine, but he never spoke. So the parents simply got used to having a silent son in the house. And he was 14 years old, and they were having dinner, and the son put down his soup spoon and said, "The soup is salty." And the parents were devastated, fell right off the chair. And they said, "Wait a minute, you know, Tom, you can talk?" And he says, "Of course I can." And they said, "For 14 years you haven't said a word. Now you say the soup is salty. And what are we supposed to conclude from this?" He says, "Well, up until now the soup was all right." Well, the point is, it's an insight, it's a cute joke. But the point is, you never comment, really, about things that are all right. And you never try to change anything that's satisfactory. Now, you may try to even preserve it, but you only preserve it if you're uneasy about the thought of it being taken away. And this applies for people also about religion. The only reason whatsoever one person changes their religion and goes to another is because the old one is making him uneasy, and he believes the new one will make him easier, will ease his discomfort. Now,
are you saying then that truth doesn't influence him
comfortable? It's a good point. The question was, does truth influence him? That's why I should have emphasized perhaps more perceived discomfort. When I say perceived discomfort, it does not have to be real. I think everybody has been in a situation where they've watched a truly engrossing movie, and say the movie is set in the desert, and the guy is like a Lawrence of Arabia type situation, and they're very thirsty, and the sand is going down their backs. Well, it may be 20 degrees out there, but while you're sitting in the movie theater, you start feeling thirsty, you start feeling uncomfortable. It's perceived discomfort. It isn't real, it's what you feel. Now, therefore, the truth of a person is, the truth may make him uneasy, illusions may make him uneasy. I'm only talking about personality here. See, what I've done is I've really cut it free in a certain sense from the concept of truth because I've gone back to basics. Sometimes truth makes people very comfortable, therefore lack of it bothers them and they seek truth. Sometimes truth makes them very uncomfortable, so therefore they run away from it. And, you know, again, very simple, the simplest analogy, of course, is the criminal. If he commits a crime, finds out that he's wanted for the crime, and runs away and changes his name. Why? Because the truth is something that makes him uncomfortable, because he'll be put in prison, where he'll be very uncomfortable. So he runs away from the truth. Now, by the same token, the man who wins the lottery sees that the ticket is the proper number, he runs to the store to cash it in, because the truth makes him comfortable, because now he's uncomfortable without the money which he can just get by picking things up. The point is, truth is it will be brought in later, and it's a different concept, but it isn't always truth that motivates people. Sometimes it's their perceptions of truth. And of course, by the same token, people could be totally wrong. If you went to a doctor and he misdiagnosed you and told you you had 6 months to live, you would live your life as if you actually had 6 months to live. It's not true, but that's your perception of it, you see. And that's the key point here is, it's perceived discomfort. It doesn't have to be real. It's only what you think it is. It's ultimately what your brain and your heart and your mind tell you. Now, again, I freely admit that sometimes we will go through tremendously major efforts to avoid a minor trouble. And sometimes a major problem is followed or is caused by a minor effort. In other words, what I'm trying to say here is the response and the stimulus, to use the fancy psychological terms, are not necessarily equal. I once heard a definition of a human being as human beings are people who will take great pains to avoid small ones. And I thought it was very interesting. And in psychological testing in labs, when they use pain as a motivator, and we talk about minor pains like pinpricks or something like that, or minor electrical shocks, they have found that people will risk a great deal of pain, potentially, to avoid very minor pains guaranteed. And I think our everyday life shows that. So the point is, again, a massive major problem, say of a disorder in a family or something like that, will cause sometimes only a very minor response, while sometimes a very minor response will cause a minor problem will cause a massive response. Once again, unfortunately, we see it all the time in the newspapers, where a man gets fired from his job and he goes back and kills 15 people at his place of employment. This seems to be becoming a fad these days. Or a guy, the fellow, the madman who killed those 22 people in Texas recently. He was angry at the county for some reason and took it out by killing people. Well, this truly is madness. We don't understand why a minor problem. I mean, this guy still had his eyesight. He still had his ability to walk. Obviously, he wasn't destitute. It wasn't as if he were thrown in jail for 70 years for crime he didn't commit. It was a general rejection, which I think all of us have suffered at one time or another, leads to an incredibly out-of-proportion response. And that is something that is simply human nature. There are certain things about us which are quite literally unanalyzable. And why we sometimes will make this tremendous response on a small thing, or a major thing will elicit almost nothing from us, who can tell? I don't know. But the point, again, I'm trying to make is, a major thing sometimes will result in a minor action. Again, we're still dealing with basics. The nature of man, both before and after the fall, at least certainly before the fall is presented to us in Genesis, and after the fall by our own personal experience, is that we seek autonomy, license, liberty. I'm avoiding using the word freedom, because freedom has a moral concept to it. What I mean by autonomy and license and liberty is the lack of coercion by an outside source compelling a person to behave in a certain way. The removal of restraints. Man wants things his own way. It seems self-evident, but we don't say this enough. We are all motivated by our own selfish desires. The ancient Greeks used to say that man is the measure of all things. Unfortunately, he isn't. God is the measure of all things, and God's truth is. But Adam and Eve, to get back to the real basics again of human behavior, wanted to be like the ancient Greeks. They wanted to measure everything their own way. And there again, we're talking about what motivates people, and now we're trying to bring it into a religious context tied up with the nature of truth. One of the problems about truth is a restriction. You cannot, once you learn that 2 and 2 equals 4, have it equal anything else and expect people to deal with you. You pay a price, and the price is called reality. If you don't take care of your health or take care of your teeth, nature will play a bad trick on you and deprive you of them. So you're not free to disregard your diet, disregard taking care of your teeth, disregard even taking care of your feet without paying a price for it. These are restrictions which no man can avoid. We may wish to deny them. We can deny them with our mouths. We can even fully believe that we're going to live forever regardless of what we do with our health. But the fact is, it doesn't work that way. So man, unfortunately, is in this sense of rebellion, seeking his own license and liberty. Perfect example of it, and the clearest example of it, was Adam and Eve in the garden. They wanted to learn for themselves the knowledge of good and evil. For some reason, and I think it's because of our own personal hang-ups in this culture, people tend to think that the original sin was sexual. The original sin was quite clearly an act of rebellion because Adam and Eve wished to obtain knowledge of good and evil by themselves. Like the ancient Greeks, we want to measure it on a human standard. God had already revealed to them good and evil. And he said, this was good, this was evil, don't do this. They said, in a certain sense, thank you very much, God. But you see, sir, we are no longer children. We now want to find out for ourselves. And that was the sin that they committed. And the devil, when he tempted them, told them a half-truth. They did find out for themselves. As the Bible says, their eyes were opened to the evil that they had done, which before they had only known intellectually through faith by belief of God. Now they internalized it. I mean, again, Genesis is not simply a metaphor. It is a profound observation into the human experience. I talked before about the concept of theology, where you can either have the heavy emphasis on the the part, which is God, or the ology part, which is the human activity. In a certain sense, Adam and Eve were the first theologians, with a very heavy emphasis on that ology part. They wanted to find out the knowledge of good and evil for themselves, and they did. To them, the end, which was knowledge, justified the means, which was rebellion and sin. Again, they wanted to find out for themselves by means of themselves. They wanted to be both their means and their ends. They wanted to be their beginning and their end. They literally wanted to be self-contained and, like the ancient Greeks said, be the measure of all things. Unfortunately, there's a penalty for that, and it is rejection of God and sin. Again, we're not free to do that. There is a penalty to be paid. The process became important to them because the process of discovery and experimentation, and that is exactly what they did, made them adults. The difference between an adult and a child is a child plays for entertainment. He amuses himself. The adult does things for profit. Now, by profit, they don't always only mean money, but the adult is goal-oriented. The reason the adult will do something is to get an end result. That is why adults are always telling children, take your toys back in, because the child plays with the toy and leaves it alone. But the adult will plan for the future. The adult puts the shopping list up on the refrigerator, because that list alone and going to the store, all of those things are motivated towards an end. And frequently we see younger teenagers who are, in a certain sense, motivated without motive, wander about the malls endlessly. They sort of are in that half-child, half-adult state. They want to go to the store, but they don't know what to buy. The child usually goes to the store and buys the first thing he sees. The adult goes to the store usually with a preconceived notion about what he wants to buy, because the adult is profit-oriented. Actions must have profits. Adults decide for themselves. They think for themselves and they seek for themselves. Again, unfortunately, there's an unpleasant aspect to this, and that is that Jesus told us we must become like little children to be saved. Little children live in a world of unknowable forces, of good and evil. Powers completely beyond them. Again, we can only remember our own childhood, when you were being dragged around by some adult, and you frequently would get, run into the knees of adults, because you couldn't walk as fast. You couldn't control things. You had no idea. They just dragged you around all over the place. If you went anywhere, they were always telling you to hurry up, and you were walking as fast as you can. These things were beyond your control. And that was the world that children live in. They live in a world not of their own making, at the mercy of older and more powerful beings. They live in a world, however, which is filled with faith and trust. They live in a world where they don't worry about who pays the rent, or the electric bill, which is why children tend to leave lights on, or the gas bill, which is why they tend to use too much water, or the grocery bill, which is why they tend to not put the jar back on the peanut butter so it goes bad, because they simply have faith and these other people who take care of them. They don't worry about tomorrow. They are the way Jesus told us. Don't worry about tomorrow. So now, your first personality type, which I'm going to now list, is the one who wants to be the adult. He may be a non-Catholic or he may be an ex-Catholic. But the point is, this person wants to use his adult brain, his adult ability, and his adult ambition to control his world. He wants to be his own king, his own emperor. He wants to be the ancient Greek and measure everything by his own standard. And his religion is part, maybe a large part, maybe a small part, of his world, but it will be controlled by him. This is the classic Protestant, the classic Martin Luther. I will interpret the Bible my own way. I will be supreme in my own conscience. I will decide what is right and what is wrong, and I will tell God what I have decided, and I will, in a sense, give God an ultimatum. Even Adam and Eve hid once they committed the sin, because they felt guilt, they understood the shame. This type of person is acting in a shameless fashion. He must control his reality, he must control his religion, everything must be profit-orientated. And the prophet, again, is to ease his own discomfort, and his own discomfort is he lives in a world where he cannot control everything. Catholicism, unfortunately, cannot be controlled. As I said before, once you accept that 2 + 2 = 4, or once you discover it, you no longer have a choice of allowing it to be any other value. There's no choice to this. Once you realize what the IRS means in this country, you have to pay the taxes or you suffer a penalty. Now, you can vote for someone, but the point is, quite frankly, until the laws change, you must accept the laws. There are many aspects of our lives which we no longer have control over. This adult-type personality says that I will control as much as I can. I want license, liberty. Again, not freedom, moral concept with freedom. That's why I keep going license and liberty. I want no controls on my life, or I want as few as possible. Therefore, rather than accept the reality of the truth of Catholicism, he accepts instead a system where he can tailor-make things, where he can pick and choose exactly what he wants. So he is the type of guy who says 2 plus 2 equals 4, but 2 plus 3 also equals 4. Now, 3 plus 3 equals 6, I'll accept that, but 4 plus 4, that equals 8 sometimes, and sometimes it equals 9. You see, he wants to pick and choose his truths. Unfortunately, our system doesn't allow him to do that, unfortunately for him. Because it means for him to, if he has to accept the entire system, he no longer has his, quote, freedom to choose. The pro-abortions are very right when they use that term. Freedom to choose. They're dead correct. They really do phrase it correctly. They want to say, in this sense, they want to hide behind the concept of privacy, the term and the mask that they put behind their thirst for human blood and human license. Human, not freedom, but lack of restrictions and lack of standards. I have even the right to kill my own child. Notice the right to kill my own child, because a right by definition is something you may choose to exercise or not. It's not an obligation. They don't want obligations. They don't even want obligations to kill children, although they probably all would. They want the freedom of choice. And they hide it behind the word privacy. What an interesting concept. I don't know how much they realize they're revealing of themselves. Adam and Eve sought privacy after they committed their sin. They hid, literally, in the bushes or wherever they hid, and for the first time they put clothing on themselves. Why? Because now they were private. Before they weren't. The concept of nakedness being prior to the fall meant they were not private. They quite literally were, in many ways, two in one flesh. They did not see them, they saw themselves as a family unit. They didn't know they were naked, because the clothing, outside of its protective value, is primarily a privacy concept. These people, privacy. What I do in the privacy of my own bedroom, what I do in the privacy of my own house, what I do in the privacy of my own conscience is nobody else's business but mine. I am the measure of all things. And they hold that religion is a personal matter. And the key thing to approaching people like this is to understand that concept. And that's the first question for the second part of the session, is religion a personal matter? Now, that is the first personality type you're likely to run into. And my experience has been that generally if you run into one personality type, you will not run into the same person, a blurring of another type of personality type. Okay, so in other words, if you run into this type of person, he'll be very persistent and very consistent in that view. And it ultimately comes down to, thank you very much, and usually they don't even get angry, thank you very much for expressing your views, they're simply not my views. Okay. The second type of non-Catholic or ex-Catholic you're likely to run into is what I call a social type. He or she is not a Catholic because it would cause some problems at home, quote unquote. Now that doesn't mean to say in their own physical home, but it means that it would cause some problems in their social setting, in their environment. Generally, these people have no doctrinal problems whatsoever with the Catholic Church if you do bother to explain it to them. So it's not a matter of they'll say, well, listen, I can't accept the assumption or I can't accept the real presence. As a matter of fact, very frequently they'll have an interest in these things and they'll actually listen to you at great length. That is not the problem. They won't disapprove of Catholic morality either. Usually they'll praise it. They'll talk about how good it is. But there's something that usually comes down to this. My family were always Lutherans. If I do that, I would hurt their feelings. My husband would be very upset if I became a Catholic. My mother would never speak to me again. My grandfather would turn over in his grave. My great uncle was a minister. What you're talking about is a social problem. Now, in both of these cases, I believe there is an approach one uses. And the fancy psychological term is cognitive dissonance. I only say that because eventually you might hear it. All cognitive dissonance is the exposure to a person that there's something wrong. And it goes like this. If a person says that he values A, and I don't care what A is, but let's just use a concrete personality, punctuality. If a person says he values punctuality, and yet he does something which reduces the probability or the frequency of punctuality, in other words, he shows up late for work an awful lot, or in his social events he shows up late, or he's late for school, then you must assume one of several things. Then these are exclusive. In other words, one of these things will definitely apply to the situation. Number one, he's a liar. He really doesn't value punctuality. Number two, he's a lunatic. In other words, he's controlled by forces beyond himself. He's demonically possessed or something like that. He can't show up and work because the spirit of Bertrand Russell is talking to him, telling him he's coming late. Okay? Or number three, he doesn't understand that his actions are in conflict with his values. And this is very frequent. I believe that most marriage counselors, whether good or bad, simply are bringing up cognitive dissonance when they try to counsel families. What they're simply saying is something like this. Do you really want to be married to this woman? Yeah. Do you realize you're driving her away? All of a sudden, if the marriage counselor is good and the man is sincere, he might say, oh my gosh, you're right. I want her and I'm driving her away by this activity. Therefore, there's a conflict here. Do I want the activity more, like going out every night drinking with the boys, or do I want my wife more? Which do I really want? I can't say I want both because there's a cognitive dissonance here. I have a conflict of values. A value conflict or a behavior value conflict. Okay. Now, assuming that the person you're dealing with, either the adult or the socializer, is not a liar, and assuming that he's not a lunatic or demonically possessed, we have an approach that we suggest. Okay? And what you have to do is try to show a step-by-step program where what he's saying is not in adherence with what he's doing. You must, in this case, attempt to expose the problem. Now notice, what we're talking about is psychology here in a certain sense, the motivation. I didn't talk about anything about, you know, proving the Immaculate Conception or something like this. Get down to the basics. Do you value truth? Yes or no? That's why I keep coming back to the concept of truth. If he says yes or if she says yes, now, do you value truth more than your social relations? Do you value truth more than your, quote, alleged freedom? That's quite a bit different from now arguing papal infallibility. You're not arguing Catholicism, you're analyzing the person and trying to set up the situation. In general, the adult would be saying to you, nobody tells me to become a Catholic. That's his ultimate answer. That's what's written in his heart and his soul. The socializer says, someone tells me not to become a Catholic. That's essentially what those answers are. So you're dealing so far with two types of personalities. One is the freedom lover, the adult. I want to be in control of my life in as many areas as I possibly can. You've taken many freedoms away from me. You're not going to take this one away. And you present a restrictive program. And the second, the socializer. I'm not willing to pay the social penalty that would occur if I entered your church. People would laugh at me. Especially people who have gone from one religion to another sincerely. If they now become a Catholic, people will say, oh, there they go again. This is like people who change political parties. It's an embarrassing thing to do. It takes a certain sense of moral integrity to do that or personal courage. Because what you have done is you have said, at all the other times I asked you to vote for me as a Democrat and I supported the Democratic Party, I was wrong. Now I'm publicly telling you I was wrong. We might accept this all once, but what if the man, after being a Republican, went back to being a Democrat again? Oh, everybody would wipe him off. I don't know if you recall, but Joseph Stalin's daughter defected from the Soviet Union, came over to the United States, and everybody welcomed her with open arms so she could find freedom. I don't remember how long she was here, and then she went back to the Soviet Union saying, this place stinks. I guarantee you every American said the same thing. Loony. Loony. What's wrong with her? You can actually understand a person leaving the United States and going to the Soviet Union. You might think they're strange, they have perverted values, but at least they're doing something, and they're going one way. But the person who comes from the Soviet system, finds freedom, lives in it, then goes back to the Soviet system, denouncing both sides, people say, forget it. The social pressure on a person not to change on something like that is tremendous. And that's what it is. It's the social pressure. Okay. The third type, which I believe you're likely to run into, is the straight, old-fashioned sinner. Talking about... Now, the other people, in a certain sense, are sinners, too. But their sins are sins which have, shall we say, a fig leaf on them of a desirable motive. It is desirable to behave, at least at times, as an adult, trying to gain control of your life. I mean, that's what we all try to do with our children, is to raise them up so they have control of their lives. It is a desirable thing to keep social relationships on a pleasant level. So therefore, even though these people may be sinners, they don't necessarily see their activities as sinners. However, there are those types who have the straight, old-fashioned, straight-out, 100% sinners. These are the guys with the second wives. These are the Mario Cuomos, whose lust for power and ego is impeded by morality of his former church. So therefore, he rejects his former church while still claiming to be part of it. This is the mafia chieftain, who just like Mario Cuomo, wants power, wants authority, wants status, but the moral system of the church in which he was baptized says you can't have this. So he claims to still be part of it, still sends his children there, sends money over on contributions, and in the meantime, totally and completely ignores it and behaves in a violent, horrible, offensive fashion. This is Martin Luther. Because he refused to repent and reform, simply redefined sin as virtue and virtue as sin. He just changed the words around. Why? Because he was a sinner and he chose not to conform to God's plan. It wasn't a matter of theological problems, it was a matter of pure, simple lust for evil. This is very common. And it is very, very wrong if you don't recognize this type of person. Because he's immensely different from the adult type and he's immensely different from the socializer. This type will usually mask his evil by an apparent rational disagreement with the church on a few issues. In other words, this is the guy who will have the theological problems with the assumption. Or he just can't accept papal infallibility, and he will appear to be making a rational discussion on it. What I'm telling you now is based on my own experience, and I can't say it is always true, but I believe that it is always true, and it has been for me. When you deal with these type of people, they will expose themselves always to be evil, as opposed to a rational disagreement. Again, he will appear to be rational by two characteristics. One is, he ultimately will start showing a great deal of hate. And when I say ultimately, sometimes I mean 15 minutes. And I mean hate. I mean personal, nasty attacks on you, personal, nasty attacks on the Blessed Mother, and hatred, shouting, violent words. He will be incapable of carrying on the mask of the rational discussion. The second is that when he starts to quote sources for his rational disagreements, they will always be vehemently anti-Catholic sources. And when it comes to something like you point out that he can't find this in the Encyclopedia Britannica, he will either not look at the Encyclopedia Britannica, or he will say that it is a Vatican-controlled thing. Every rational attempt you make to discuss with a person like this, he will dismiss things, always. He will go back on himself. He will quote the Bible on one page and then on the next page say that the Bible doesn't have any meaning when you quote back. This is a pure sinner in the sense of that what this person is seeking evil, serving evil, tormented by evil. He knows what he's doing. This is not a situation of cognitive dissonance where you're pointing out this guy's in a value conflict. No, he's not in a value conflict at all. His values are different from the right values. He already smells the sulfur fumes of hell. And his pride, and that's of course all it is, that's all that causes such sinful anger, will not let him go free. Because in order to free himself, he must submit and reform. And to submit doesn't allow him to hang on to his pride, and that's the only thing he has. The only thing the sinner has is his pride. Shakespeare defined, I think it was envy or jealousy, as the beast which feeds on itself and grows larger. Pride does the same thing. In this case, the key approach is not dogma, not rational discussion, but you're dealing with the sinner. And I'll get to it in a moment on how I think you should deal with him on that, because I wanted to go through the other types, at least while we still got to one side. And let me check the tape right now. So now we have three types. The adult, the person who wants control of his life. The socializer, doesn't want to pay the social prices to come in. And the sinner. There are other types. This type, I have no idea how common it is the simple, ignorant person. This is the fellow who simply doesn't know what Catholicism is or is not. He's never been told. And he's never been asked to come into the church. And I give two quick illustrations. I once attended a hostage negotiation training session. It wasn't a big one. It was just to inform us of what the nature was in case hostage situations ever arise and how police should react. And they pointed out many of the policies, and essentially they are to keep talking, keep negotiating, don't make commitments, and always just try to wear the guy down little by little over and establish relationships. The point was, they talked about one hostage situation where the hostage negotiators, the police, used this, and it ended quite successfully after about a 4-day or a very lengthy hostage situation. It doesn't matter how long it actually was. And when the guy gave up and gave the hostages in without any harm, they were trying to do what's called a debriefing to learn for future things. And they found out that the hostage taker, the criminal, wanted to surrender immediately. He didn't want a hostage situation. But nobody ever asked him. The police had become so bound by their psychology of negotiation and of compromise and of temporizing and of stalling that no one said, are you willing to give up the hostages? Apparently it took the police 4 days before they even thought of this. This guy was willing to give them up right away, but nobody asked. Well, it's an interesting point and a true story. We simply, these people, the ignorant, haven't been asked. They haven't been approached by anybody. Again, I have no idea how many of them there are. These people you deal with on dogma. These first, an invitation. Second, dogma. I'll point out that during my research, I went to a Baptist church once, and I went to Baptist church frequently. I developed a long-term personal friendship with this guy until he found I was a Catholic and ultimately wouldn't see me anymore. But I remember one time when I went in his church, all in the hallways, almost every square yard, there was a sign, a piece of paper with 56 written on it. A full, 8.5, 11, normal letter-sized piece of paper with 56 in big block letters written on it. And I said, what is this? And he said, I can't tell you yet. It's part of a program, and I made a promise not to tell anybody. But when I reveal it to everybody else, I'll reveal it to you also. I said, fine. And it turned out that 56 stood for 56%. Because one of the organizations that he was associated with published a survey, or they got one of the major polling groups, Harris or Gallup, to do a survey on why people belonged to the church they belonged. And they were as surprised as I was, and I considered myself an expert, to find out. Down, I think, at the very last was theology. Close to the very last was things like the minister. Much higher than that were things like parking arrangements, daycare center, music. But the biggest percentage, 56%, way over half, was they were invited. Someone just knocked on the door and said, would you like to come to my church? And the people said, yeah, sure, what the heck? And that was why they made a lifelong commitment. 56% were invited. And that's why 56% of the people in America, and I assume this was a Protestant denominations, were in there simply because somebody came to their door and knocked on the door. And I knew a Catholic couple who, when a minister of the local Protestant church took over, he came to the door and invited them to come. And they mentioned that to me because it happened to be one of the guys I was doing research with. And I thought it was interesting that he would just go door to door and try to get his congregation that way. Now, how many people did he get to come? I have no idea. But again, and I don't see any reason why people would lie about this on a poll, 56% of the church-going Protestant, apparently public, in America, went to the church they're in now for one reason: somebody asked them.
So the point is, how many people are not Roman Catholics because they've never been asked?
I don't know. But you are likely to run into these, and the only way to find out if they exist is to start asking them. Now, an approach to an ignorant person is quite different. And the approach to the ignorant person would, let me inform you. Would you mind if I speak? And now you're not going to get objections, unless the person is ignorant in the sense that he's been told the wrong things. I was discussing with an issue last night, and a fellow who is essentially becoming a Catholic and trying to defend the faith said, well, my friends pointed out that according to the Bible, St. Peter was married. And I said, yes, definitely. And he says, and St. Paul talks about that he would have a right to travel with a wife. And I said, yeah, definitely. He said, well, your church teaches priests can't be married. And I said, no, my church doesn't teach that at all. And he said, why? What? I said, it's purely an administrative decision, which is relaxed at various different times. And for roughly the 2,000 years of the church history, there was a married clergy in the West for roughly 1,000 years. So it's been about 50-50. And as I pointed out, there's a deacon in my own parish who is married and who has received permission to become ordained as a married priest. So what do we have? We'll have a married priest in my very church. Well, the point is, this is pure ignorance on this fellow's part. He thought it was a doctrinal thing always taught by the church, when in fact it's simply an administrative decision which has been sometimes rather strictly enforced and sometimes not enforced at all. It's a matter of ignorance in a case like that. So that is frequent. How frequent? I can't tell you. Okay. How do we approach the ignorant? Differently than you approach the others. Okay, and I'll try to summarize those quickly. The next type, the demonic. And by demonic, I mean demonic. I mean devil worshippers. I mean, now how do you find this out? Well, if you're starting to sense it, and I'm no expert on these things, I don't smell devils, but I did find that one way is to ask them to denounce Satan, or ask them to say that Jesus is superior to Satan, and they won't. And I found that many fundamentalist Christians, quote-unquote, won't. They are pure, 100% devil worshippers. And I'm talking about pure Satanists. I'm talking about the type that explain why there's so many missing children in this country. They are sacrificed in the basements of these demonic churches. It doesn't say First Church of Satan. It says Full Gospel Center, like the one over on 55. That's a demonic church. That church worships Satan. They call him Jesus, but so what? Go over there sometime and ask those people to denounce Satan, and you'll find out they don't. One of the characteristics I noticed of people that I suspect to be demonic is that they never seem to be bothered by the weather. Their hair is never out of place. There's something not human about them. If any of you ever seen Bill Baird, the famous pro-abortion advocate, you'll get the same impression everybody else has. There is something just the slightest bit off about him. There's a texture to his skin, his gestures, his motions, which is not normal human. Can you deal with these people? Can you evangelize the demonic? Well, if I understand the technicalities of it, there's perfect possession and imperfect possession. Perfect possession, forget it. You can't do anything with these people. Imperfect possession, you can. It depends on the degree. Gee, I don't know. But I don't know how often you're going to run across them. Okay? Now, even then, should we try to evangelize them? Yes. Why? For the same reason we should try to evangelize anyone. Number one, neither they nor you are yet in hell. So therefore, there is hope for both them and you to get to heaven. If you are an instrumentality of getting them to heaven, I'm sure God won't forget it. And if you are not, God won't forget your efforts. Either way, you increase the chances of both of you getting to heaven, and salvation is the only thing that really matters. Second, you're dealing with a demonic person. And again, I found with demonic people, they do not get upset ever. They don't show normal emotions. Now, I'm talking about the real demonic people, not the ones who have the devil whisper in your ear, and that's a separate matter. And I'll tell you how you can recognize this one. This one I'm pretty good on. If you're dealing with a person, say, over a period of time, it's a situation where, let's say, you meet the person periodically or you have a nodding acquaintance or something like this, and every now and then you see, you'll find that especially if you have a long-term program and they're somewhat open to it, usually these people start out ignorant. They say, well, I'll listen. Sure, I don't mind. You'll find that maybe the first two or three sessions, they're actually coming closer. You get an awful lot of questions like, gee, I don't know. That's a good point. I'll have to think about that. Then what you will get is a stone, steel wall slammed in your face. What has happened is that the devil who is assigned this person has been seeing this person going to hell. Now all of a sudden, devils being sinful and being slothful, they get totally lazy. They wake up and realize that this person is now in danger of going to heaven. And what they do is they redouble their efforts. As Jesus says, when a devil is thrown out of a person, he wanders around in waterless places and then comes back with seven worse than himself, and the situation gets worse. You'll see it happen if you evangelize enough. I've seen it happen numerous times. The person is very open for quite a while. And again, you can see a lot of the cognitive dissonance working. You can see all of a sudden he says, I can't explain things without purgatory. All of a sudden it realizes, it starts to wear on him that he doesn't know what salvation means. Yes, there's an awful lot of passages been that I never made any sense out of. No, you got a good point. That's the only answer to this one. Gee, I don't know how to explain it any other way. And then all of a sudden you call him on the phone and he's hysterical and he hangs up. Or you try to make an appointment and he won't see you. Or when you do see him, he runs away. And he plugs his ears, or he shouts you down. That is where demonic situations coming in. But, as I point out, among other reasons why we should still try to deal with these people is it's excellent practice. Also, it shows the real influence of demonic presence, which too many of us only give intellectual consent to. We think of the devil as this guy who looks like a goat occasionally on a situation comedy, wears a red outfit and shows up in a puff of smoke and tells a few jokes. No, it's a terrifying, horrible presence. And it's not bad to come up against him every now and then to instill a fear of him in you, a fear of winding up with him. Also, the discomfort that we sense with people like that, our own sense of helplessness, will lead to a discomfort, which, like all discomfort, leading to a matter of activity on our part, because that's how activity comes about, is through discomfort. And that can lead to a redoubling of our efforts with those people who are not demonic. And it makes you more aware of such signs either in yourself or in others. Because we don't know who the devil's going to grab next or try to. And if you start to see that happen with somebody you know or someone you like, you can see a warning sign. That's why, absolutely, we should still try to evangelize the demonic, in my opinion. So again, now, we have four major types here. I believe it's four, maybe it's five. We have the adult, the person who wants responsibility in his own life, control in his own life. He wants everything done by his own standards, in his own way. We have the socializer, the person who's not willing to pay the price. We have the straight old sinner, which is different from the demonic, by the way. This is a person who consciously chooses every day to continue in his sin, okay? Like the mafia chief. The devils don't bother with those people, because they say, I got that guy anyway. There's the ignorant. And there's the demonic in some form or another. Five different types. Now, what I'll try to do is through a series of questions is give some suggestions on how to approach them, but I'm late and we should have taken our break, so let's take it now, please.
Thank you.
I was looking, I got one more footnote here, and I guess we could sort of consider the last category of people that we might come across are those who are lazy. They simply don't know what's there, and they simply don't go to any church or do anything. And I'm not really sure if that fits into any category, because I tend to think that God takes care of them by making them discomfort already. So anyway, briefly, what I would say is, just to give you a rough idea of how to approach people, and I'll try to do it more in the last session, always be clear about what your intentions are. Hello, I'm a Roman Catholic who has recently become convinced that I have to try to invite other people into my church in order for me to be saved or increase my chances of salvation. Therefore, I hope you don't mind if I try talking to you. I have found, so far, in literally hundreds of cases, no one has ever become offended at that. You think they might, but I always ask you to put it the other way. Those of us who find Jehovah's Witnesses annoying or stupid or heretical or demonic or joking or foolish still admire what appears to be their sincerity of going out and doing things. And almost all of us admire people who are willing to take an effort, whether we agree with them or not. We admire the fact that they're willing to do something. We admire the fact that they're taking the effort to do something. And what I have found is, now of course you will, the odds are you're going to run into the person who just tells you drop dead, but that's the person you could try to give $5 to and he'd say, drop dead. He doesn't want anything to do with you. He's just a crank, hates every human being who's ever lived. But the point is, the first thing on any of these people is simply express your intention. And
I think at that point, people don't think you have, quote, a hidden agenda. And that makes them less suspicious, and it's more open. You've been frank, you've been honest, you've been courteous. That does not turn people off. Exactly what you want to do from then on is another question, okay? But one other thing I would throw in is that somewhere along the line, and this is a matter of your own judgment, I believe there is always the necessity for a personal confrontation. Confrontation sounds like a nasty word, but I know no other word that can describe it. It doesn't have to be nasty. What you ultimately do have to say to someone, somewhere along the line. Now, of course, if you intend to see a person over a period of months, this doesn't mean you say it the first day, and if the person dies before you say it, don't feel bad about it, okay? But somewhere along the line, you have to confront the person with the fact that by staying out of the church, they endanger their salvation and they reject truth. And it doesn't matter how you phrase it in the sense of you can say, I really don't like saying this, but I feel I have to. It's the same sense as, again, recovered alcoholics will tell you, or recovering alcoholics will tell you, that ultimately what you have to do if you're the boss is give them the ultimatum. You show up drunk once more and we fire you. We like you, but we'll fire you. Do this once more and you're out of the house if you're the husband or the wife. Tough love approach. Somewhere along the line you have to do the personal confrontation. Those are the two general guidelines that I would give for anything. Okay. Now, with that in mind, let me try by the ideas of questions, okay, to deal with this. The person who says, or the example, like if a Jehovah's Witness came to your door and said, fine, we want to talk to you about this and stuff like that, and you invited them in, and you said, I'd like to talk to you about Catholicism, and they said, fine, but I'm only here to talk about that, all right? I'm only here to talk about my religion. I'm only here to share my truth with you. And therefore, be inappropriate for me to listen to you. I'm interested in proclaiming my truth. That type of person, how would you give me an idea of what you think that person would fall into? What kind of category? And how would you try to break it down? Go ahead. Take a stab at it. Because quite frankly, the Jehovah's Witnesses are the easiest ones to deal with. Easiest in the sense of, quite frankly, eventually they'll knock on your door. Number two, you're really not worried about offending them. And it's good practice. They're willing, at least formally, to talk about religion. So it's very good practice for you. I mean, if you don't want to go and talk to your neighbor or your friend or the person on the bus or the car or something like that, or the person in the carpool, then this is not bad practice. But if the Jehovah's Witness gives you that answer, what would you say? What type of person are you dealing with? Are you dealing with a sinner? Are you dealing with ignorant? Are you dealing with lazy? Give me a stab there. What? I know you're dealing with a cult, but what personality type are we dealing with? Joan?
Ignorant.
Ignorant. You really think so?
Oh, I would.
Oh, yeah, but is that... All right, I understand that. But when I said ignorant before, it's the type who've been taught the wrong information. Would you simply start putting... When we did a Joan, it didn't work that way at all, did it?
Well, you insulted
him. Well, I insulted him by wanting to take the recording at Joan's house. But the point is, do you think ignorance was their problem?
Not his.
Okay, what was his problem? What was his personality type?
I'm bright.
Of course it was bright. So you're saying, now notice, the Jehovah, well, let me give you a tip. A Jehovah's Witness is never a social type. He's the anti-social type. The Jehovah's Witness joins his cult in order to be rejected by his family. Oh, absolutely. The Jehovah's Witness seeks persecution because he's a masochist. I've mentioned this before. The Jehovah's Witness goes door to door, so he gets the door slammed in his face, so he gets spat on, so he gets called names. This gives him a sense of value. And the fact that his family rejects him makes him feel wonderful.
Seeks persecution
to give him a sense of value. People are paying attention to him. And the only way you can have the attention drawn to you is by doing something absurd, offensive, and ridiculous. Then they persecute you, then you feel you're important. So it's never a social concept with him. He's not the problem. That's not the problem at all. Okay, what you're dealing with is perhaps a sinner, and I'm saying in that way you would take a personal confrontational approach of, hey, do you know what you're doing is wrong, and argue straight fact versus fact. But the other thing that I think, okay, is you're dealing with the concept of the adult. I tried to tip it off in the way I said it. Fine, I came here to talk about truth.
So therefore, it would be inappropriate for me to listen to you. Okay. Cognitive dissonance. The classic approach. Is talking about religious truth a good thing, Mr. Witness? He'll say yes. Therefore, if I talk about truth, it's a good thing, right? You expect me to listen because it's a good thing. Why wouldn't you listen? There's something wrong here, Mr. Witness, if you won't listen to me. Because if you think it's good to talk and good to listen for anybody, I'm anybody, therefore it's good for me to talk, good for me to listen, what is your problem? Now, at that point, you'll be able to sort of put him into a category, because he'll either become hysterical, in which case you're dealing with a straight-out sinner, or if he truly is ignorant, at that point he might say, you got a point there, let me listen. But if he insists on controlling the situation, you're dealing with the guy who wants to be an adult. All right, now how would you deal with it further? Well, at this point, you might, again, point out, isn't there a value problem here? Again, use the exact words, don't be subtle. Isn't there a value conflict here, Mr. Witness? You expect me to listen to you, and you don't want to listen to me? Well, he might say, well, we have the truth, you don't. Says who? How do you know? Are you infallible? Do you have an infallible source? Now what you're dealing with is authority, and you're dealing with the value of truth, and then you can bring up the whole concept of the institution of the church from the second session, and that's a separate matter, and now you're on your grounds, you see. But what you did was try to peg him correctly. What is his problem? Again, the concept of the cognitive dissonance. What you're trying to do when you approach people is to point out that there's something wrong in them, and the discomfort which they feel, and they all do, is not due to some external source or some coincidence. It is due to an internal conflict. The Jehovah's Witness, and I'm using him only as an arbitrary example, the Jehovah's Witness is either sincerely convinced of what he does or he is not. If he's sincerely convinced and God leaves him alone and doesn't cause him problems, then we're worshiping the wrong God. Because the God who sent his son to die on the cross for me and the Jehovah's Witness doesn't let him go to hell easily. And therefore, he assigns a guardian angel and he bothers him daily. He whispers in his ears hourly. And he doesn't let him sleep well at night. He bothers him a lot. So therefore, if he's purely convinced, he's got the internal conflict. And if he's not convinced, he's got an internal conflict on his own because he sees the problems. Don't think that the smiling face and the well-groomed appearance are evidences of a peace inside. It's non-existent. Again, Joan can tell you how quickly that faded with the Jehovah's Witnesses over her house when she invited me over. And if you had gone with me at the time, I went to the Kingdom Hall to get them when they all came in off the road and asked them if I could go inside and talk about religion, and they wouldn't let me in. You would see how nasty they came very quickly. Jehovah's Witnesses are very, very nasty, pernicious, cruel people. They are very, very prideful and very, very hateful. But like good insurance salesmen, they masked those emotions until they got you hooked. Because the good insurance salesman will agree with you on anything. Just to smile and be nice. And no matter how many times you say, I don't need insurance, get out here, just keep smiling and just keep talking. Otherwise, he's not going to sell insurance. Everybody knows that. And if he's a good insurance salesman, he'll convince you he's a nice guy and he'll convince you that he really likes you. He's a good actor. Jehovah's Witnesses are not that good of actors. Yeah?
Do you think that you can categorize a whole congregation with the same characteristics?
Absolutely. Can I characterize a whole congregation with the same characteristics? Yes.
You can't with Catholics, I don't think.
Yes, you can. Okay. You can in the sense of that you can tell what a good Catholic should be. All right? I mean, literally. It's right in the Bible. The gifts of the Holy Spirit, the fruits of the Holy Spirit. We should be peaceful. We should be patient. We should love one another, right?
That's what we are.
Right. But you see, the reason, and that's a good point, the reason we are not is because we fail in doing what we're supposed to. Okay? But good is quite different from evil. These people are not failing in doing what they're supposed to because their system is evil. Example. I can't characterize all the policemen on the New York City Police Department because they have a large variations of personalities. And the reason I can't is because the police department, certainly on paper, is designed to do good. So therefore, if the police officer tries very hard to do good, he will be brave, courageous, temperate, he will be just, he will have compassion, and he'll be diligent and industrious. Now, some of those guys foul up and don't meet that standard. But I can tell you this, the personality of the mafia, absolute, all the way down the line, very rigid. That is exactly why to become a made member of the mafia, you have to have roots back to certain villages and cities in Sicily, and occasionally from Naples. Why? Because they know the personality type. Evil is an easier thing in a certain sense to adhere to, because then when you are living up to that, the evil, you must fit the certain personality type. Yes, one of the things I found about all forms of Protestantism is that it is based on personality. It's not based on doctrine at all. The people who join the Jehovah's Witnesses are not those who believe it, but those who feel comfortable in that type of cult. Again, I remember asking a long time ago, you know, people, ministers, what would you do if you had this type of guy? They said, we'd ask him to go to another church. What about salvation? Well, his personality is better suited for a Baptist church. But what about salvation? And they always look at me strangely, like, you know, why are you dealing with this? We're talking about IBM versus Woolworths. You know, IBM wants you to dress in certain ways. They want you to behave in certain ways. They want you to develop certain attitudes. If you don't, they ultimately will ask you to leave. Now, you don't have an IBM type working at Woolworths. And you don't have a Woolworths type working at IBM. Now, if you said to somebody, well, what about making a living? They would scratch their head and saying, you can make a living at Woolworths or McDonald's or IBM. You can make a living working in a lumberyard. What are you talking about in here? Money's money. And that's the point. The Protestant denominations, including the Jehovah's Witnesses, have worked first on pure personality, nothing more. Pure personality. The sense that you get going into the Episcopalian church is such a tremendous... This joke, and I mean, Protestants laugh at this hilariously. I'm not sure how well Catholics get it. But there's this man who was... he was a Baptist, and the Baptist minister noticed that the man's family was always in church, but the man was not. And... It got to him. So ultimately, he took a run out to the guy's house, and he said, you know, Fred, he says, I don't see you in church on Sunday. And the guy sort of avoided the question, and ultimately he says, you know, Fred, tell me why you don't come to church. You don't like me or what? You send your family. He says, well, I'll tell you what, minister. He says, you know, I'm a poor dirt farmer. I can barely make enough to keep things going. Really rough. I says, I have clothes that I can put on my wife's back and my children's back, fit to go to church, but I don't have anything decent to go to church in. So the minister says, is that the only reason, Fred? Yes. So you had good clothes, you'd come to church. So absolutely, minister. So the guy goes back, works at the Board of Elders, and they get a gift certificate for the Taylor Shop and Sound. They send it to the fella, and nothing happens. The minister still gets up, doesn't see the guy in church. Weeks pass. Now he starts to think, well, maybe the gift certificate they bought, the tailor kept it, or maybe this guy lied to me. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. He goes back out there and says, Fred, did you get the gift certificate? Yes. Did you get a suit made? Yes. Was it satisfactory? He says, minister, I put that suit on, I stood in front of me, I couldn't recognize myself, I looked like a banker, I looked like a successful businessman, I was absolutely perfect, I was stunned, this was the greatest thing anybody did for me. You can't believe the image I got, this book of success and prosperity and health and wealth. Oh, it's marvelous. He says, but Fred, we still don't see you in the church. He says, well, now that I look that good, I have to go to the Episcopalian church. Well, you see, Protestants love that joke. It's perfectly correct. You can't be a poor Episcopalian. You're not allowed. You can't be a non-demonstrative Baptist. You can't pray silently in a Baptist church. Not allowed. You can't be a sincere, hard, rocked Methodist. It's not allowed. Because Methodism has nothing hard. Methodism has nothing sincere. So, what do? You go to the next church. Or you form a small group inside of it. But the point is, you keep your mouth shut. And the tone of it is set totally by the personality of the peoples involved. It has, those denominations have no doctrines whatsoever, zero. Again, if you simply look on the cable systems with the Protestant networks, you'll see that the mainline denominations come in and they wear their gowns and they wear their things and they come in singing. And Jimmy Swagger goes up there with a little tie loose, you know, sweating his head off. The theology means nothing. It's absolute, pure personality. So can you talk about a personality type? Of course, much more with a Jehovah's Witness group, which is almost always somebody rejecting another group and joining the Jehovah's Witnesses, than you can say anything else. The Moonies, you know, not far from here, Reverend Sun Yen Moon. His people have a definite personality type, of course. That's why always people are accusing them of drugging these people. My gosh, they must be drugged. They all behave the same way. Now, they're not drugged. Well, they might be drugged, but it's not necessarily true drugging this that way. Again, the concept of the Nazi in the movies is very easy to portray. Why? Because the Nazis did hit for certain personality types. You had to really agree with Adolf Hitler in your heart that being blue-eyed and blonde-haired and Aryan made you better. And you had to really like those pretty uniforms. And you had to really think that Slavs and Gypsies and Jews and Poles were under people. People who were not worthy of the name human being. You really had to believe that. So we have these images, these stock images of Nazis. But the point is that that does reflect the way real Nazis were. Absolutely. Because evil has a certain conformity. Because to conform to the evil, all you have to do is exercise the vice. And the only reason you're going to get into the organization is because this vice attracts you. Again, I would point out that if you ever went to Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion, you would find everybody behaving exactly the same way. Why? Because they're evil. And this is this particular form of evil. Now, you could be another evil type person, but you wouldn't feel comfortable with Hugh Hefner. The personality types and the vices which are emphasized in Hugh Hefner's Playboy philosophy are of a hedonism and a sexualism and a sensualism, which, if you like, you immediately find it attractive. But the point I make again is, why Catholics are not the same is the same reason why police officers aren't the same. The reason police officers aren't the same is because they have standards to live up to. I would say you would find that every bad doctor behaves the same way, while those who try to be good fail miserably. I would guarantee you that you find every bad teacher in high school leaves early, comes late, doesn't check the homework, and uses the same teacher's guides where he gets the tests from, and teaches the same thing year to year. The teachers who try to do good, a vast variation of personalities and effects, because sometimes they fail, sometimes they don't, they have personal problems, they're trying to experiment, sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. But again, I would also guarantee you if you went into any high school today that was badly run, it would look like every other high school that is badly run. Why? Because the principal doesn't care about the kids, and he ignores the problems. That's the definition of a bad principal. Now, those principals who try, however, you'll find various different personalities and effects, because who knows what problems he's up against. See, when you have given yourself up to evil and achieved the vice, it's very easy. Again, if you were to go into the board of directors of Salomon Brothers, you know, this big brokerage firm which swindled millions of people out of millions of things, I imagine you would see everybody looking exactly like cookie cutters all the way through. Why? Because the evil was greed. And greedy people are attracted that way. And they played a game to get there. They wear a uniform. But again, if you went into a business that were being run correctly, where they were trying to do honest things, they might fail, but then you'd see a lot of different personalities. So of course, when you're talking about the evil groups, you can exactly define the personality that fits in. The stereotype, which of course is absolutely correct. Today, the black subculture stereotype is so obvious. The way the young men dress, the way they talk, the way they behave, the clothing they wear, the rejection of the Christian value that the black subculture is now teaching has put these people into a form of stereotypical behavior and conformity, which is, you know, devastating. These people wouldn't accept it every other way. What? Because it allows them to express their sense of violence, their sense of ruthlessness, their sense of rejection of values. And again, that's the adult type, as strange as it seems to us. They want to control everything their way. And that's why they won't even speak proper English. They want their own black English, because it's the ultimate rejection of the culture. So they form their own subculture. They listen to rap music too loud so it hurts their ears, and of course it sounds like dogs howling. But that is the absolute rejection. That's why they all listen to that same music. The intelligent music listener has, as it's said, the Catholic taste. He listens to many types of music. The unintelligent music listener will go from fad to fad, but while he's in one fad, that's all he'll buy. And that's exactly the point about the Jehovah's Witness. They are all the same. They are brainwashed. They are conditioned. And they choose that. It's not that kids get kidnapped off the streets, by no means. They are that way. And the reason they are that way is because this is what they feel comfortable in their sense, their own sense of sin, their own sense of pride. And again, that is why a Baptist church in New York State will be very similar to a Baptist church in Alabama, will be very similar to a Baptist church there, especially if it's like a black Baptist church or a poor Baptist church. Oh, people will be exactly the same. But interestingly enough, the theology will be tremendously different. Tremendously different. In one Baptist church, I remember asking people about this, they teach that speaking in tongues is from the devil. The next minister comes in, he teaches it's a sign of being pre-elected for God. They have to change their theology overnight on what was from the devil is now from God. Next minister comes in, what was from God is now from the devil. And they see nothing wrong with that, as long as the personality fits from the way we've been behaving. That's all. Do we still sing the same songs? Do we still wear the same choir robes? Do we still start at the same time? Do we still have the annual supper with no hot dogs? Or with only hot dogs? Oh, I'm not joking. Those are very important decisions among Protestants. Those are incredibly important decisions. Theology means nothing. But the length and color of the choir robe means everything. Because at the time is the personality of the church. And again, they're nothing but social clubs. Again, think about it. A social club, a ladies' luncheon, by definition, use the word ladies' luncheon as opposed to businesswoman, you automatically know who's going to be welcome there and who isn't. You know. Now, if someone comes in who is not welcome, she's going to be asked to leave. And you can therefore say, oh God, it's the ladies' flower club again, oh my gosh, you know. Okay, you say, oh, so it's the woman's business club again, oh my gosh, you know. Again, if you've ever been at an anti-abortion demonstration, these stereotypes of the other side are incredible. Angry, bitter women and militant homosexuals. Every single one? No, but 98%. Bitter, angry, nasty. After a while, if you know, when people have been involved in it, like I have, and it's no extra, you know, a bit of insight on my part, you can look on TV and tell from the spokesperson before they ever say a word who's who. And you can tell exactly what they're going to say, and you can tell exactly when they're going to get angry. Of course. Now, the pro-lifers are different. The pro-lifers fit into all different categories because they're both good and bad because they're trying to adhere to a thing, a goal, which unfortunately our fallen human nature and the devil tries to keep us from doing. We fail. But what you're talking about here is, of course, the personality types. That's why I was trying to point this out. Now, I'm not saying which denominations are which, but you'll run into the personality types reflected in the denominations because that's all they are. Is social groups based on personality types. And again, ask them. They will tell you. If you don't fit our personality type, we ask you to go somewhere else. Theology, truth, has nothing at all to do with it. Try to go to a high-class Presbyterian church, if you are a man, without wearing a shirt and a tie for 3 weeks in a row, and you'll be asked to leave. Even if you wore a sport jacket, you'll be asked to leave. And I'm not joking. We don't want you. You're disrupting the service by showing up like that. Now again, go to a Catholic church and see a range of dress ridiculous, from, you know, cut-offs and jeans to very proper dress.
Yeah, that's a very interesting comment that you made. I had a word person in the South Point stay here. She just happened to come to the office to talk and said that his father had been very religious. He was a Baptist and was raised in the South. And he was away from home. He was someone who worked away from home. Tennessee. And that he didn't go to church, but he saw that his daughter went to church when she was home, his wife went. But when he was on the road, he went to the Catholic church.
Why did the Workman Baptist go to the Catholic church when he was on the road? What was his answer?
He said, you know, when I go in there, he said, I see all kinds of people. There's a lady there hung with jewels. I'm there in my overalls. Nobody makes no difference.
Right.
And he said, a priest invited me to a wedding in the city. He was an Irishman, apparently over in the city, and he had friends in the city. They're having an Irish wedding. Well, he just had the greatest time, and he thought this priest was just... He didn't fit the mold of a Baptist minister.
Of course. See, they have molds. That's exactly the point. I think one of the strengths of Catholicism, obviously, you know, in a short session, I can't deal with it, is that we have personality types which you are allowed to express. And I deal with that in one of my tapes, The Proofs of Catholicism, that only we allow you to be the personality you are without asking you to change. Number one, we have a saint which was just like you and made it to heaven, guaranteed, no matter what you are. And number two, if you want to become a religious, we got a religious order that emphasizes your personality and de-emphasizes the other characteristics. So if you want to be very extremely intellectual and studying books all the time and go through endless amounts of studying, we'll make you a Jesuit. But at least in the old days, if you wanted to just deal with people, run around, be happy, get a little bit overweight, we make you Franciscan. And that's exactly the point. You want to be a Trappist and go around and be incredibly silent and do penance all the time? Yeah, sure. You want to be disgraced? You want to be put away in a cell by yourself? We got you for that too. You want to be in the world be doing nothing but nursing people who are going to die? We got a place for you too. You want to be a soldier? Want to be a priest? Want to be a monk? Want to be this? Want to be that? Whatever it is, we got room for you. And that's one of the points about Catholicism. And this guy, it's a very interesting point that you make of this Baptist who said, like, not so much I felt at home, but everybody was there. I occasionally get a call from an old girlfriend of mine who is a Baptist, and she has a severe weight problem, and she's in a miserable marriage. She has a severe weight problem intentionally. She puts the fat on to drive her husband away. She knows that. She tells me exactly what she's doing. And it's a miserable, miserable marriage. And I was talking to her about becoming a Catholic, and she says she doesn't go to the Baptist church anymore either. Why? They look at you there. And they say, like, you know, blah, 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 and this and that. I know, it's strange. When I was talking to the guy who was this close from becoming a Catholic last night, I said to him, have you ever been to a Mass? And he said, no. And I said, you will be devastated. I said, because you won't understand it at all. Simply because, as I pointed out, so I was supposed to, I usually pick it on Wednesdays outside of Planned Parenthood abortion clinic, and I didn't go on Wednesday because I severely burned my arm. The people didn't see me there, and they worried about me. I ran into them at church, and they saw me with what looked like a cast on my arm at Mass. And I had to tell this guy, Keith, that they didn't ask me, and I didn't talk to them. Because even though they now thought my arm was broken, they were not at Mass to find out my health. And I was not there to inform them that I was all right. We ignored one another. And I said, it will be the hardest thing for you to understand that Catholics go to church to be with God, not to see who else is there, what everybody else is wearing, and to make it a social club, because that's all Protestants do. And I sometimes think that the reason we have statues is exactly that. So that if your mind wanders, at least you look at the statues, not what everybody else is wearing. And if you look at the statue, you got a good chance of coming back to what you're supposed to be thinking about. But without the statues, the Protestant women have nothing to do but to memorize what everybody else is wearing. Because there is no theology. None whatsoever. There is no belief system. None whatsoever. Nothing. Zero. So what do? You go together and you come on a social club. That's exactly all it is. And if, like every other social club, you do that. I mean, you know, again, the Boy Scouts of America have a certain personality type which certain boys don't fit in on. They join, they quit immediately. Little League teams have certain personalities. The boy joins, he doesn't fit in, he quits. This is throughout every social organization. And Protestant denominations are nothing but social organizations based on personalities. If you don't fit in, and the gentleman you're talking about here is a perfect example of it. Many people won't go to churches, they're Baptist churches, they go all their lives because the ministry changes. That's it, I'm not going. And that's why there's so many Baptist churches. So they keep splitting and splitting and splitting. A Baptist church was this very large thing. You might have 20, 25 active members. It could fit 250 people. It has 25 active members because it split 17 times. It built when it was strong, when there weren't many places. Then they had some argument, and probably not about theology, but about length of choir robes or the music. Or somebody put a picture of Jesus up. Well, that's idolatry, and that's the end of it, and I'm not taking it down. Well, you people leave. And that is exactly what they encourage each other to do. I've seen their internal magazines, and again, it's not secret. They think this is so obvious. How do you resolve problems? All four steps were leave, 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 leave. There was never a thought about that somehow truth could be found and one side would be asked to accept it. No. And there was never even a thought of throwing people out. No. Just ask them to leave. And they'll leave on their own anyway. Well, you leave. They leave. And therefore, you can make these rash generalizations, which aren't rash at all, about different personality types. Anyway, the point I was trying to drive at, because I think we're almost out of tape.
Is the first step in evangelization with a personality type is by no means doctrine. You don't start with, hey, let me show you how reasonable purgatory is. It's try to figure out what makes the person tick, where he or she is coming from. What is the basis of this person? What is, again, the personality type? Now, I said those are the personality types of the non-Catholic. I don't think it's exclusive, but those are the major types you'll run into. And they could be the ex-Catholic, too. I would say many people who fall away from the church, many do it for social reasons. The social group they run around with no longer goes to church. And if they went to church on Sunday, these people would make fun of them. Or they would just make a side comment, just one. But when you're a teenager and peer pressure is so important, that's what you get into. Or You don't want to go somewhere and be thought of as a holy Joe or someone who takes religion seriously. Oh my gosh. And point again, if that's what you're dealing with, then use the cognitive dissonance method. What's the real value here? Do you believe there's a last judgment? Again, don't talk about the termination. Do you believe there's a last judgment? Do you believe you have to adhere to some things in order to be saved? Are those some things pleasing your friends now who may die before or after you but won't get you into heaven? Is that what's important to you? Cognitive dissonance. Something's wrong here. What is it? And again, those first two or three steps of trying to feel this out, you haven't brought up a doctrine. You haven't brought up an encouragement. You haven't brought up a saint. You haven't brought up a church teaching. You're analyzing. You're very much like the doctor who does the diagnosis first. Come in. Let me take your temperature. Let me get your pulse speed. Let's do these chemical tests. Let's check your blood. Let's check your weight, your height. Okay, now sit down. Now, what's your symptoms? Then, what does he say? Do you smoke? Do you drink? Do you eat fried foods? Do you exercise? First of all, let's get some real data. Then let's ask some questions. Then what does he say? Well, this is what I think you should do. You should exercise like this. You should take these pills. And you should have that growth removed from your knee. Okay. See? But he doesn't come in right away and say, let's get that growth removed from your knee. And you should exercise because he doesn't know your background. And that's what I'm saying. Before you do the prognosis, before you do the therapy, do the diagnosis. But I still would say the first step has got to be don't delude him. I'm a Catholic and I'm convinced I have to try to evangelize. So I can do that by talking to you. And I hope you don't get offended, but I feel I have to do it. And again, I have found no one has ever gotten offended at that. No one. And I guess I should have put this first, but I'll make it my sort of summation remark. You must have the faith in God that when you open your mouth and say that, that he's prepped the guy before. The surgeon doesn't operate on the person until he's been prepped. The antiseptic's been spread over his body, so the infection isn't going to spread. Well, when you come into surgery, it's been prepped. Somebody's taking the x-rays, somebody's told you everything. You have to believe that. Because God has a plan for them and a God plan for you, and you have to function in faith, because there isn't any other way to function. You must believe in him. You must believe that this person has been prepped to hear you. Maybe last night they had a dream that this would happen. Or something, somewhere, triggered them. Again, I find it's gotten so routine I don't even pay attention to it. What someone discusses with me today, someone will ask me about tomorrow. So I'm been prepped to give the right answer. And I just rely on that all the time now. And it happens all the time. You must function in faith, and you must believe that God knows what he's doing, and he has a plan for them and a plan for you. And that's really where I'll end it, because I think it's a good place to end it. And the last session is essentially a call to evangelization and a emphasis on feelings, which is something that we don't sell enough. We have a tendency to think that feelings drive people outside the church. I want to use it as our selling point on bringing people back in. And we'll sort of try to wrap things up at that point. Okay? We'll end with a prayer. Name Father, Son, Holy Spirit, Amen. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil. Amen. Name Father, Son, and Spirit, Amen.